This week on Potlatch, anthropologists and anthropology. Levi Lott interviewed some residents of his native Tulixak to find their attitudes about anthropologists who study natives. Here are some reactions.
Sucks are the white men who come into the villages and started analyzing the customs or the way of living the villages make. I would suggest they learn the language first. And then, therefore, they wouldn't make any mistakes in analyzing their cultures. And then, otherwise, if they don't know how to speak the language, I would not prefer that to happen.
I don't think it's that good to analyze anybody. You know, just it would seem like it'd make a judgment on them. I don't really think anybody should be studied, you know. I think they should just go on living the way they are living.
I know, but under Western civilization, we gotta have written history, you know, in order to preserve our culture. Who do you think is best qualified to do that sort of thing about our own culture?
I think the Eskimo people, the Indian people of Alaska should do that, you know, just study their own background as far as they can go, and it could be translated over to the anthropologist or something. I really don't have any grudges or anything. I don't have any feelings towards anthropologists or anything like that, or any people that study it.
And I think maybe we can study it ourselves, because we know what goes on around here.
Now some urban natives comment. First Claude Dementiff and then Tommy Richards Jr.
Anthropologists, you have to understand that they've been trained to study other groups, and when other groups are studied, that is called anthropology. However, when that same trained individual study his own group or his own self, it's called sociology. So the difference between the two leads on to a whole bunch of questions, such as exploiting, things like this. I believe that for the most part, anthropologists unintentionally have exploited the people and have not contributed to their growth from their findings. Now, the native people cannot directly see any benefits from the studies of the anthropologists. At least I myself cannot. If the findings of the anthropologists were made aware to the native people and say, you guys came from such and such a place during such and such a year, that's all fine and dandy. But I think the factor of time within the native culture has not a finite or a definite meaning as it within the white culture. What I mean is that so what if we came from such and such a place during such and such a time period? Today is now, and I think we should look toward the future and learn from the past. Anthropologists tend to not look at that type of situation, but rather seek the past to find the future. Whether that is good or not for the anthropologist, that's a question for himself to answer. Whether it is good or not for the people who are being studied, I believe there is no answer.
Traditionally, the anthropologists have not been too concerned about their subjects. I think that's changing, but I think that the anthropologists and social scientists can be of value to Native people at this time. I think we will have some threats that we'll have to face, perhaps originating from groups or agencies like the National Park Service, which is now developing proposed regulations for subsistence usage for native subsistence usage of National Park Service withdrawals. These regulations are being drawn up after a consultation with anthropologists. I think it would be useful for regional native corporations, both profit and non-profit, to obtain the services of anthropologists and social scientists to gather information which would back up continued native usage of traditional subsistence lands. I think that anthropologists could be of value to us in that way, and I don't think we ought to discount them. I think that we ought to think of how they can now serve us, because we have some problems that we will need the help of scientists to solve, I think, in the next couple of years.
Programs about anthropologists. One anthropologist, Roger Powers, told Levi Lott there are four types of anthropologists. First, archaeologists who dig into the earth for information about past cultures. Then there are linguists who study the languages of people and how the languages of people relate to their cultures. There are also physical anthropologists who study such things as human biology and the evolution of human beings. a social or cultural anthropologist. Now, these people study modern living peoples. Powers told Levi that often the social anthropologists do studies which benefit the people they are studying. For example, some are studying the effect of land claims on Native Alaskan groups. Powers and Lott discussed the discovery of a woman frozen intact on St. Lawrence Island. Three brothers from Savunga found the body frozen and naturally mummified. The body had washed ashore from a mound onto a beach during a storm. The anthropologists from the National Park Service arranged with Savunga villagers to bring the body to the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus to find out how old the body was and how the woman died.
She was then ultimately brought into Fairbanks for basically biological studies to try to find out why she had died and how old she was, because it's a very rare thing that we actually ever get to look right at, a person. Now, we see bones a lot. We see a skeleton sometimes in excavations, or one finds human teeth. But to actually look right at the body of the carrier of a prehistoric culture is a very unique thing, particularly in the Arctic. So we were very fascinated by that, and it was determined by radiocarbon analysis that she was about 2,000 years old. The old places that the Eskimos lived, what we archaeologists call a site, an archaeological site, represent old villages. And we get the information through digging. This isn't haphazard digging. We call it excavation to make it sound a little better. But it's a very systematic way of digging up the ground, in which we lay out a grid system and we dig square by square and carefully record the vertical and the horizontal position of everything we find, drawing it as we go and photographing it extensively, so that when we finish, we can hopefully we'll have a very detailed plan view of all of the things discovered. And oftentimes this will be the remains of an old house with the stone and bone and ivory tools that they used in their food quest and in processing their foods and making clothing and other kinds of equipment. And the bones of the animals that they brought in from the sea and the land for food can be analyzed in terms of which animals they were and how old they were when taken.
When I read a book, I always believe anthropologists deal with mystic art and digging graves.
We don't deal with the mystic arts. I'm sure somewhere there's one that does, but I don't, and none of the people that I work with do. Oftentimes what we do looks like pure drudgery, and people come and look at us and watch us in the lab. But what we're really trying to do is to understand the ancient populations in terms of their biology and their culture, the ancient cultures, and to essentially try to understand the whole history and the prehistory of the native peoples of Alaska. The grave question is one which is really quite sensitive and I think has to be addressed. Anthropologists do, on occasion, excavate graves. They don't dig them up just for the fun of digging them up and tearing them out of the ground. This isn't the point at all. Like with the question of the woman, the frozen lady, we don't usually see somebody in that condition, but while we study the ancient cultures, we also like to know what people were like, too, in terms of their population dynamics. And these skeletons that are taken out do provide an awful lot of information that a specialist in the lab, a scientist, can derive. You can learn a tremendous amount about their health, the general health of the people, what they died from, what diseases they had, what kind of nutrition imbalances may have existed, and quite a number of things that are very useful in just filling out the picture of a prehistoric population.
Why do these people from outside come into our home and study us? What do you think about, if there were more natives working on these matters.
Okay. Why do people come into your home to study you? Really, is that some of us find you very interesting people, and that and not just strange or quaint. That's not the point at all. It's an interest that a lot of people have in different cultures and the way that different peoples live, not just in Alaska, but all over the world. Anthropologists work in the United States among the white population, mm-hmm. too, and Europe and Africa and Asia and Polynesia. Really, their main purpose is to try to document the vast variation in human culture. For so long, all we really knew about human culture was from sociology and the studies of urban peoples. And it became quite clear that even from a scientific point of view, if we were ever to really formulate any laws about cultural development or variation in culture, that we had to have the data. We had to have the information. So that is why some people study other people. The Eskimo and the Northern Athabascan peoples are of real interest to a lot of the anthropological world and the world at large because of this unique adaptation to extremely severe climatic conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And similar peoples are studied in Siberia and in northern Russia, where they live in these cold tundra and taiga forest conditions. And this is a very unique and very special and successful adaptation, and we just simply want to know as much about it as we can. I think the other thing, too, is that there is a strong need for the Native peoples of Alaska to find some way to become interested in anthropology, and if possible, we can take courses to the bush. We would like to train professional anthropologists who are Native Alaskans so that they could study themselves and their own people, and their own history, their own culture. It would be the best thing that could happen.
You ever use that oral history working along side by side with the findings?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this has done a lot. And I think there was a time when even anthropologists tended to mistrust oral tradition because mm-hmm. There was no way to check on it. You couldn't go read a book.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't cross-check to find out whether something was just purely mythological or whether it really contained some historical fact. More and more, all over the world, we find, particularly through archaeology, that folk tales, the oral histories, while sometimes embellished through time and changed, do contain important historical information. And this happened this past summer to me.
Mm-hmm.
I found some strange stone structures in the Seward Peninsula, looked like old houses up on top of volcanic buttes. And the Eskimo people in Deering, I weren't surprised at all. I mean, they knew they were there, and they told me that was a very ancient battleground, and that people had fought there, and that one group had come to try and get the people on the top of the hill, off the hill, and they kept losing and losing the battle all the time. And some of those structures on the top of the hill looked to be much more than just houses. They were heavily walled up. And one of the Eskimo gentlemen, it was Alfred Carman from Deering, who was with us, remarked when he got to the top of the hill that, boy, these people were really dug in. So that, we don't have any solid confirmation that there was a great battleground there. In order to find that out, we would have to do some digging, excavate the area. But I pay close attention to these tales.
There are many, many tales that are not recorded. And like when I was younger, my grandmother used to tell me all sorts of tales, you know. And I've forgotten them. I wish I had a tape recorder during that time.
I think this is something that could be done. There's no reason in the world why these tales should be lost. And every time an old person dies, a tremendous amount of oral history goes with them unless it has been recorded. The white anthropologist, of course, has done this in the past, but I think it would be a real service to one's native culture if more of the younger or middle-aged native peoples would take the time to sit down and talk these tales out, have the old people tell the tales, write them down, get them on a tape recorder.
A Lewisburg Blues, the Lewisdale Blues with John Fahey. Now this report from Tana Beebe of the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs is responsible for the overall management and protection of 13 million acres of forest lands on Indian reservations. It's also responsible for the supervision of nearly a billion board feet of timber per year. Forestry is big business then for a number of reservations, but it is also a big problem. One tribe along the Pacific Ocean in the Northwest is the Quinault Indian Nation. This tribe is battling to save its forest land from bad logging practices and liquidation. Tribal economy is dependent on forestry economy, and reforestation is a major priority. Guy McMines, a resource development specialist, says there is a great need for a long-range management plan.
The forest in Indian country were managed on a liquidation basis, and the major part of the proceeds have gone to interests outside of the reservation. We certainly don't mind other people benefiting from our resource, but the problem has been there's been no reinvestment in the natural resources. This is a national problem in Indian country, and I think it's even a problem in national forests and BLM land, but on the reservations it's severe because there has been very little attention to the reforestation of our property, and all the things that go along with reforestation programs. For example, on the Quinault, the money was just made available for a comprehensive soil survey. This soil survey will be used to determine which kinds of trees grow best on the reservation.
Guy McMind says tribes also have trouble obtaining a proper inventory. In other words, they're too poor to get an accounting system to keep track of the growth of their trees. It's important, McMind says, to be able to project for the future. The search is still on for Alaska Natives who may be eligible to participate in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Congress opened the door for additional enrollment when it was discovered there was a substantial number of people who missed the 1973 enrollment deadline. Commissioner of Indian Affairs Morris Thompson says it was out of compassion that Congress opened the rolls for those who were left out of the settlement.
In any human public program, anytime someone gets left out, it's a saddening event. We'd like to see 100%, but I don't know that that will ever be attainable, but we do want everyone that thinks they're eligible to apply. We enrolled approximately 70,000 Alaska Natives, probably in every country in the free world and every state in the Union. The enrollment program ends in December, but the benefits that will accrue to the regional corporations and to stockholders, we hope will go on in perpetuity, because the benefits, they will be landowners and as individual stockholders in the various corporations, and we hope that they'll all be successful and continue to pay dividends to their members.
That was Morris Thompson, Commissioner of Indian Affairs.
Everybody thinks my head's full of nothing, wants to put his special stuff in, fill his face with candy wrappers. He bouts sex and revolution, but there's no hole in my head. Too bad. Call me a dupe of this and the other. Call me a puppet on a string day. They don't know my head's full of me and that I am my own special thing and there's no hole in my head.
Too bad.
I have lived since early childhood figuring out what's going on. Something I want to listen to there. A kind of bird song up somewhere there. Keep walking the way I mean to go and there's no hole in my head. Everybody thinks my head's full of nothing. Wants to put his special stuff in, fill a space with candy wrappers, keep out sex and revolution, but there's no hole in my head. Too bad.
Malvina Reynolds. This is Jeff Kennedy. Thanks for listening. Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.